From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, stories of high strangeness with investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe, followed by, of course, conversations with Linda. By the way, before we get things going, happy birthday to Randy, also known as Moondog, from your friends and your wife, Kat. Hope all is well. Here's what's happening. Well, for nearly a decade, a band of cyber criminals rampaged through the servers of a global business, who's who. Among the victims, 7-Eleven, Dow Jones, NASDAQ, JetBlue, JCPenney. Prosecutors say the hackers stole conservatively 160 million credit card numbers. And the dollar value of the crimes that they helped facilitate is enormous. Just four of the victims are out $300 million. The suffering caused to identify theft victims was immeasurable, according to prosecutors. Five of the gang's members were indicted. One is in custody in the United States. A second is awaiting extradition in the Netherlands. Three more are still at large in what U.S. Attorney Paul Fishman says is the largest data heist case ever prosecuted. In a moment, consultant and former hacker Kevin Mitnick joins us about this truly incredible story. The United States government has demanded that major internet companies divulge users' stored passwords. That's yours, according to two industry sources familiar with these orders, which represent an escalation in security techniques that has not previously been disclosed. So now they're after your own email passwords. Can you believe that? SAC, S-A-C, Capital Advisors, one of Wall Street's largest and most profitable hedge funds, has been indicted on criminal charges for its role in insider training, allegations that could cripple the nationally known firm. Now, though SAC Capital billionaire founder and head Stephen Cohen has not been charged individually, the indictment announced by the federal prosecutors charged that his Connecticut-based hedge fund and three of its affiliates with wire fraud and four counts of securities fraud. In the 41-page filing, prosecutors outlined a corporate structure and culture in which portfolio managers, research analysts, and supervisors allegedly participated in a decade-long scheme that involved trading in at least 20 companies and profits of at least hundreds of millions of dollars that they made by obtaining non-public information from employees of publicly traded companies and other sources. Trends research expert Gerald Celente with us. Gerald, first of all, what is a hedge fund, Gerald?
Well, these are scammers. What they do is they buy up other companies with pennies on the dollar. They then rape the companies, fire everybody that they can, and resell them and make a big profit, kind of like what Mitt Romney made a living doing.
But with all this, with what they're doing, they claim like insider information. So apparently they knew something.
George, LIBOR, $700 trillion worth of mortgages, loans, student loans, auto loans, you name it. The whole game was rigged. I'm not making that up. That's a fact. It's rigged everywhere. This isn't any news. It's old news. If you're not in the game, then you don't win. How do you think these guys make all this money? Because they're so brilliant? No, really, the whole thing is rigged. Go back to the one they keep talking about. Oh, we cracked down on that guy Gupta, you know, with Goldman Sachs. You know, Goldman Sachs, they got caught a couple of years ago. They paid a $550 million fine. That was like about a week's worth of work. This guy Gupta got 2 years in jail, and they keep going on. You're talking about SAC, $14 billion. They'll hit him. They'll give him a slap on the wrist. They'll get some low-hanging fruit,
yep.
and the game will go on.
They want to find them and get that kind of fee money, don't they?
They're trying to make it seem as though they're doing something when the whole game is rigged.
Gerald Celente's website, trendsresearch.com. Gerald, we're going to have you back so we can talk with you at length about stories like this. Only a sliver of alleged crimes committed on board cruise ships Winds-up reported to the public, according to a Senate committee report. Leading industry bigwigs promised to make changes. Listen to this. Of the nearly 1,000 incidents reported to the FBI by cruise companies since 2011, only 31 of the crimes have been disclosed publicly on a website maintained by the Coast Guard, according to the report. One of the drivers of a train that derailed in northwestern Spain, killing at least 80 passengers, has been put under formal investigation now. Speed will be a factor in this inquiry, as security camera, which you can see online, captured the train crashing as it went around a bend. Now, he was going apparently at twice the speed you're supposed to. So something was wrong there. Now, here's something I thought you should know. First of all, honeybees rented out to pollinate crops from apples to watermelons, returned to their hives with pollen containing an array of agricultural chemicals that make the insects more vulnerable to infection by a lethal parasite, according to a new study. So that could be part of the problem with the honeybees dying off. About six cats pounced on a dog owner as she walked her poodle in the city of Belfort in France, dragging her to the ground, mauling her. She was bitten repeatedly and left with a torn artery that could have proved fatal, while the dog was also badly hurt. It's thought that particularly high summer temperatures may have made the cats far more aggressive than usual. Happens to people, too. And those of you who are cat lovers, scientists have discovered how allergic reactions to cats are triggered, raising hopes of preventative medicine. A University of Cambridge team has identified how the body's immune system detects the cat allergen, leading to symptoms such as coughing and wheezing. A parasite has sickened another 16 people, bringing the stomach bug outbreak total to 285 patients in 11 states, according to the CDC. And something we probably always knew, but scientists at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology have developed the ability to implant mice with false memories. These memories can be easily induced and are just as strong as real memories. Psychological proof is something psychologists and lawyers have known for years. They're making Manchurian candidates out of mice. I wonder if they've done it on people. They say a full moon can disturb a good night's sleep, according to scientists. Researchers found evidence of a lunar influence in a study of 33 volunteers sleeping in tightly controlled laboratory conditions. When the moon was round, the volunteers took longer to nod off and had poor sleep results, despite being shut in a darkened room, for example. Here's our resident psychiatrist, Peter Bragan. So why is this? Full moon, not enough sleep. Peter, what's going on?
Well, you know, this one deserves a historical look, George. You know, the word lunatic comes from the Latin lunaticus, which means moonstruck. So there's a real long tradition of believing that the moon affects people's personalities, activities, and sleep. One source says that the reason for the big overhangs in village huts in Great Britain was to keep the moon from falling on you at night. And I'm going to give you a personal anecdote about this. I've often been awakened at night with a full moon, walked out onto my balcony, looked over Cayuga Lake, seen the moon, full moon across the lake, and heard a loon with its wild call in the night, which is also associated with lunacy.
It affects everything.
I don't know yet about the science, George, but there's plenty of folklore, and my wife, Ginger, assures me that my sleep is disturbed by the full moon.
And let me tell you, Peter, law enforcement will tell you and emergency medical people that during a full moon, the cases of crimes and emergencies zoom right around that period.
Well, you know, the moon affects the tides, for goodness sakes. So goodness knows what we will discover of how it might, in fact, affect the activity of mammalian brains. I don't think it's too far-fetched. I think it's fascinating. I think it's a lot of fun. And I think the door's wide open, George.
Hey, Peter, isn't it great, by the way, to have a resident psychiatrist on a radio show?
George, it's probably one of the nicest things that's ever happened to me in my whole life. I can't tell you how much positive feedback I get. I was actually thinking about that before I went on tonight.
Well, that's great. Peter, thank you. Peter Bragan, by the way, his website, Bregin, BREGGIN.com. Go up there. You know, all the websites from everybody you hear on this program, just always take some time. Write them down, put them down as your favorites, and go take a look at them. Here's a check-in now with Peter Davenport. Speaking of websites, UFOCenter.com. Peter, it never ends. More reports all over the place, huh?
They're coming at me from all directions, George, and I don't know that they can be ascribed to full moons, but something certainly is going on. I was just standing outside a few minutes ago, marveling at the beautifully clear night sky we often are blessed with here in eastern Washington state, ruminating on just how incredibly little we humans know about the galaxy and the universe we live in. Something's going on this planet. A lot of reports. I've taken about 200 reports since my last appearance just last week. An example, Syracuse, New York, just 4 hours ago tonight, George, gentleman reports that he was standing outside looking at the night sky, and he saw a very, very bright white light just descend vertically in the night sky like a spider on a spider web. He claims, he describes that it hovered for about 35 minutes and then suddenly, just instantly disappeared from his sight. Not a very dramatic report, but noteworthy given how many similar reports we're getting of that nature. Peculiar white lights. About 2 or 3 hours before that sighting, Hagerstown, Maryland, an adult female describes that she was standing outdoors looking at a beautiful sky, perhaps a stormy sky. She saw a black disc streak out of the cloud she was looking at. A few seconds later, she looked back at the same area of the clouds and two more flying in unwavering formation, she reports, streaked across the sky. It really unsettled her, she reports in her written report to us. The sighting this morning at 8 a.m. in Indianapolis, Indiana, man saw again a very peculiar white light that just suddenly jumped to another part of the morning sky. Other drivers around him on the same road were stopping and looking at it.
Yeah, isn't that something, Peter?
Lots going on. Kodiak, Alaska this morning, a triangle of white lights went right across the city of Kodiak. And last night, a gentleman in Welland, Ontario, Canada, saw one of these peculiar orange lights. He stopped his car, got out, took a photograph, and provided us with a drawing of what he saw. Orange light was embedded in a triangular craft. People can see the photograph and the diagram provided by the witness on our website, UFOCenter.com. My gratitude to all those Coast listeners who've been submitting reports. Boy, we're getting a lot of activity.
For sure.
I don't know what's going on, George.
Peter, I'm glad you're out there for us. In a moment, 160 million credit cards hacked. Kevin Mitnick talks about that on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Kevin Mitnick is a security consultant to corporations worldwide, co-founder of Defensive Thinking, which is a Los Angeles-based consulting firm. He's testified before the Senate Committee on Governmental Affairs on the need for legislation to ensure the security of the government's information systems. And he is an expert on hacking because he was once one. Kevin, welcome back. How are you?
I'm great. It's great to be back on your show again, as usual.
Always a pleasure. Think the world of you. And I want to ask you something first. You know, all the time I introduce you over the years, I always say you are a former hacker. You did your time for it. Does that offend you? It's been years and I've never asked you that.
No, not at all, because I'm still a hacker today. The only difference is my clients give me permission to hack into their systems and they pay me for it. So I'm not even a former hacker. I'm a current hacker, but I do it with authorization, which is kind of the coolest job. It's almost like Pablo Escobar becoming a pharmacist.
Yeah, exactly. Now, this case, where it's got to be one of the biggest hacking cases ever, 160 million credit cards, $300 million at least. How did they do this for so long?
Well, yeah, 160 million credit cards. That's a lot of credit and debit cards. This case actually was going on for many years. I first heard about it when they arrested this guy, Albert Gonzalez, in Miami, and he was one of the ringleaders involved in this. And there was also a guy from the Ukraine named Masik, and Masik was the sales guy. Apparently, he he was part of a group that would sell off all these credit card numbers. And then this guy from the Ukraine was actually traveling, I believe, in Turkey, and the Secret Service had them under surveillance. They were actually there in the country, and they arrested him because they were able to seize his computer and arrested him and put him in jail. But his computer was well protected. He was using a program called PGP, and the government couldn't read his information on his computer. But apparently, once this guy was arrested and inside a Turkish prison, somehow they extracted his passphrase, his password to give access to all the information on the computer. I think it's what we call rubber hose cryptography.
Yeah.
In other words, probably some sort of torture or waterboarding or whatnot. So anyway, once the Turkish government was able to get the passphrase, they gave it to the United States with a copy of the computer, and then they were able to identify all the other people that were part of this huge credit card scheme. And the one guy that was kind of a ringleader, this fellow Albert Gonzalez, was eventually sentenced to 20 years. And then he turned to become an informant because they were going to put him away for life. So he cooperated with the government, and he told the Secret Service and the FBI everything that he knew. And they probably were doing an investigation for years. They were analyzing the information on this guy Masick's computer and were able to eventually get enough information to indict these other guys. And what's interesting is when Gonzalez and Masick were arrested and sentenced to long terms in prison, these guys in Russia and the Ukraine continued their fraudulent activity. So there was no deterrent there. And now the Justice Department finally announced, you know, that they got the rest of the, you know, rest of the game, so to speak.
Now, but what about the next time? How many of these things might be happening right now with other people?
Plenty. It's really interesting. Financial institutions and other types of companies that have this type of data hire my company to test their security. And we pretty much have a 95 to 96% success rate at actually breaking in, with their permission, of course, and getting access to all their clients' credit card data.
Wow.
Even though they're supposed to have safeguards because of certain types of regulations to prevent this type of thing. The unfortunate truth is a lot of these businesses have applications that are facing the internet. They are not programmed securely. In other words, the developers did not write these applications in a secure way. And then it leaves it open to certain types of vulnerabilities that hackers could exploit to not only grab information from like a back-end database, but actually to break into the server itself. And that's exactly what happened in this case. Is these guys from Russia were really sophisticated at exploiting a type of vulnerability called SQL injection. Now, I know that sounds like Greek, but what it basically is there's a programming language, I guess if you want to call it what they call structured query language. It's used by developers to access information in databases. And what hackers can do is they could manipulate how the SQL commands work and gain access to information they shouldn't. You know, that's kind of the high level, taking it from the high level because it's kind of complex. And so these types of vulnerabilities that these guys exploited for the last 7 years are still being exploited today as we're doing this interview.
Amazing. And you know, I've got some friends, Kevin, who do not want to make any online payments because of all these problems. So they write checks. But aren't checks just as vulnerable in that if you give a check to the wrong person, they get your ACH number and your account number, they can go online and do all kinds of things with that.
That's a great question for Frank Abagnale, isn't it?
No.
You know, the guy, and catch me if you can.
Yeah.
That's very true, because if a bad guy steals your routing number and account number, they could do, you know, ACH transactions and so on and so forth. But you have to know, if you shop online and you use your credit card and there's any type of fraud, if you're in America, the bank is basically going to take the report of the fraudulent activity and credit your account. So there's pretty much zero liability. Now, when you use a debit card and you don't report it in a certain amount of time, there might be some issues. And then there's always the issues with online banking. You really have to read the agreement you have with your financial institution.
Good point.
So if a hacking incident should arise, who is liable?
Good point. Stay with us, Kevin. We're going to come back in just a moment. talk more about hacking, and we'll also open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to chat with Kevin Mitnick. It's an incredible technology. Sometimes just goes a little too far, doesn't it? I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe. Well, she joins us with some incredible stories of high strangeness. When we come back, we'll talk with Kevin Mitnick about this incredible hacking case. 160 million credit cards worldwide stolen. They, you know, did the numbers over again. They sold them. They did everything. That's how they made a lot of money. We'll come back. We'll take your calls as well on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Kevin Mitnick with us. We'll take your calls as well. 160 million credit cards. And so they make their money, what? They steal the numbers and then they sell it? What do they do, Kevin?
Yeah, pretty much. They break into credit, you know, pretty much credit card processors, places like 7-Eleven, you know, JCPenney, you know, major brands. They steal the information, and then eventually it ends up on in the underground market. In fact, there is another hacker that wrote a great book about this. I'm trying to remember the title of the book. It's about a guy named Max Vision, and it actually explained in this book, and I'll think about it in the title in a moment. It actually explained how this whole underground market of credit cards actually works. But even what's, you know, more concerning, okay, we have a failure on the part of businesses to protect their credit information. What about the National Security Agency can't protect them, their systems from employees of stealing top secret information and walking out with the information on the USB stick? I mean, that to me is even more egregious of a situation than the, you know, credit card theft, of course, is very serious, but for a guy that works as a contractor to be able to stick a USB drive into a computer and take information off NSAnet, which is their secure network.
That's right.
You know, that's incredible. I mean, and the same thing happened, you know, in, I believe, Iraq, when Bradley Manning was able to basically take all these secret cables and write them off to removable media, CD, and pretty much walk out of the facility there with the information. So I think the amount of security failure in government agencies and businesses is pretty significant.
Kevin, will the businesses stay ahead of the hackers?
It's constantly back and forth. You have good companies out there that are coming, you know, that develop certain types of security products, and then they deploy them in the business environment. Then people figure a way to defeat the products. It's a constant cat and mouse game. And I really don't see it getting much better, at least over the next 5 years. I think it's going to pretty much remain the same. And that's from people that are trying to hack in from the outside. Now imagine trying to protect your business from people already on the inside that want to steal information. Now that's
another problem.
Obviously much harder to do.
Let's take some calls here, Kevin. Kyle in College Station, Texas, first-time caller. Kyle, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Howdy. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure thing.
First off, I want to say I'm a big fan of your book, Art of Deception, Kevin.
Thanks, Kyle.
Read it first time about 5 years ago. Loved it. I think it's really interesting what you're talking about the insider threat. And, you know, at the same time, we have this need to start using biometrics. You know, we have the new IP protocol. So we have enough IPs for every grain of sand. Everyone carries a cell phone with them, so everyone has an IP address. We have to get more personal, and we live in a world of imminent disclosure. If you don't disclose it or tell people about it, it's like they're going to fill in the blanks for you, so you might as well just give it up.
Well, I don't give mine up.
No, not at all. Not at all. You know, I've had a couple of credit cards shut down because they called and said there's been a breach, and you know, then they mail you the new one. It's a pain in the neck for people, you know, Kev, especially if people,
if you have auto pay.
Yes.
Like on my credit cards, I have auto pay for a number of, you know, vendors I do business with.
Yeah. And it just, and bang.
It's ripped off. It's a pain.
Next up, we go to Tom in Riverside, California, west of the Rockies. Tom, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yeah. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Wanted to ask Kevin, what would he do for a feedback system to stop some of that? And, you know, I think the computer system, you know, in this way, credit-wise and in otherwise socially, has went nuts, you know, and I think it's out of control. I think we need to redefine what we need to do with computers, and it's not, you know, social, and it's really destroying more than just credit. But what would you do credit-wise to, as a feedback? It seems like it could be prevented, you know, with some sort of system. What would you do?
Well, in America, it's quite interesting that to use a credit card, you don't need to use a PIN. But you go to Europe, you go to, you know, certain countries, even Iceland, I believe, and if you want to use a credit card at a merchant, you also have to put in the PIN code, which, you know, is what we call two-factor authentication, because it's basically, you know, you have the credit card, which is something you have, and you know the PIN, which is secret. Now, why companies or banks don't deploy this in the States is because the cost of deploying such a system will exceed the amount of fraud losses. So these businesses are doing is basically accepting the fraud loss as a cost of doing business rather than fixing the problem. Because how to fix the problem is make the credit card numbers worthless. One way you can make them worthless is by deploying this two-factor authentication type of mechanism. It doesn't, again, it raises the bar. It doesn't make it where it's impossible for a sophisticated attacker to beat, but it certainly makes it much, much harder. And unfortunately...
Well, how could you pay online, though, Kevin, if you didn't have numbers?
No, what basically, okay, let's say you use your credit card and online, you might have a some type of device that allows you to put in, you know, a PIN code, or a merchant, when you're shopping at a merchant site, maybe they could query some, you know, master, you know, the card issuer system and send, or tell the card issuer to verify you're the customer. They send you a text message to your cell phone, which contains, you know, like a 6 to 8 digit code, and you have to put in the code into the website before you can make the purchase. It's kind of like verified by Visa.
Oh, right. So like a double whammy then.
Over a certain amount, yeah. You get redirected to Visa's site, and then you have to, you know,
authenticate it.
To put in, you know, more information. But unfortunately, that site is, you know, not really a deterrent, because you could reset the password just by knowing the last four of your social security number. And of course, unfortunately, it's way too easy for the criminal element to gain access to social security numbers.
Next up, Cameron in Portland. That's Maine now. Let's go east of the Rockies. Good morning, Cameron. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I really appreciate it. It's very cool to be on here. And the reason I'm calling is just that a friend of mine mentioned today something that kind of it really scared me and a couple other friends too. It was, we were talking about the company, the Monsanto company, the genetically, you know, they modify seeds, and they have, you know, they have what they've done, but that they at this point may have done business with, I believe they were called Dark Waters, and it's a company that it's like a third business company, if you will, that the government can hire to get certain information from certain individuals without actually claiming to have done it, because someone else was hired to do it, let's say. And it was just something like to have, it just blows my mind that to have a company this already, so much power, there is just so much power that this company has. In terms of money, I know we already have a different conversation about money altogether, but the fact that they can do these things while at the same time...
Do what things?
That's a good point. I don't know if that's my question. Is has Monsanto in any way bought out or is using excessively this Dark Waters program? I believe they're called it this Dark Waters.
I never heard of it.
No, I haven't heard of it either, Kevin. But who knows? There's a zillion programs out there now.
Yeah, the only thing I heard with a remotely close name is Blackwater, but I believe they do physical security. Oh, and by the way, George, the name of that book that really describes the hacker underground and how this whole credit card theft process works is the book called Kingpin. And it's actually written by a hacker that we're around the same age. His name is Kevin Polson. We were both grew up in the San Fernando Valley. We didn't even know each other, but we both went on this path of being hackers, and we both ended up in a lot of trouble and in jail. And now he's the director, I believe the editorial director of Wired Magazine. And so he's written this great book. I highly suggest it for people to get an inside look on how this actually works.
Well, it's pretty dramatic stuff. Kevin, you know, as we look forward to the future and technology, I mean, give me your reaction to even what the government's doing. I mean, now they want these internet providers and servers to cough up passwords to email.
Unbelievable,
accounts.
Isn't it?
It really is.
Not only passwords, but the encryption keys used for what they call SSL. You know, when you go to your banking website, for example, and they have like the little lock, and it's supposed to be like a secure transaction.
Right.
Well, the government wants the keys to basically get visibility into what's happening under the hood. And it seems like after Edward Snowden revealed the massive spying apparatus of the NSA, that it didn't deter the NSA. It appears that they're even going further now. They'll say, oh, the cat is out of the bag, so we're just going to go and ask the companies for, you know, their users' passwords and, you know, and their certificates. What's really odd is most companies that are out there on the web that are doing the right thing actually never store the plain text password of a user. They store a hash of it. So not even the companies themselves are able to tell the government what the password is, if they're doing it correctly. But it goes to show you that, you know, we're already in the surveillance state. It kind of reminds me of the book 1984.
Yeah.
Kind of scary.
I know, and that was late. What happened? Why are they doing this?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting because I don't know if you had an opportunity to read my book, Ghosts and Wires, but
yeah.
I kind of used the same technique of getting metadata to track the FBI when I was a fugitive trying to evade them. And what I would do is I'd hack into the cell phone companies and get the metadata of who was calling and who, what time, for how long, and try to identify everybody on the team that was chasing me. And I used that intel to stay one step ahead of the government at the time. And the NSA is doing this on a much larger scale, where they're compelling all the communications providers to give them information on everybody's call, no matter if you're an American citizen or not, it doesn't matter. And then they're using this metadata to basically look for patterns that would be sent to an NSA analyst that might be something that they're looking for. Now, I really don't think that this metadata is just being limited to use for terrorist investigations. I believe the FBI, the CIA,
IRS,
and government agencies are using this for any type of investigation, and they never really had to reveal how this whole thing worked because it was a top secret program. But, you know, it's quite interesting that, you know, certain cases get solved, and it's a mystery of how the government figured it out. But now that the cat is out of the bag,
now we know.
A lot of sense.
Now we know. Let's go to Pahrump, Nevada. Let's go to Bonnie, west of the Rockies. Hey, Bonnie.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure,
I appreciate it. I wanted to talk about a couple things of hacking. About a year or two ago, I think it was about a year ago, my gas cards were hacked. I have a Chevron gas card, and it was hacked in Sylmar. Somebody, I couldn't believe it, I got my card, and it was, you know, up at its limit. Somebody had actually put $500 worth of gas in it, and we were able to find out they did it at two pumps at midnight at the Chevron in Sylmar, and I still had my card in my possession. So they were able.
So what the criminals do is they get your card number.
How'd they do that?
Well,
they had made their own cards.
You could have, you know, used a gas station that had some sort of skimming device. Maybe an attacker had compromised the company that issued the card, or
an employee was in on it.
I mean, there's several ways the actual card number and information could be obtained. And they basically encoded it on another magnetic strip and basically used it at the gas pump. But fortunately, I know it's a lot of pain and hassle. Fortunately, you should get that money back from the bank because, you know, in America, there's usually zero liability. If somebody misuses your credit card, you don't have to pay those charges.
You call up. You get a new card, and they wipe the slate clean, don't they?
Pretty much. Unless they see a pattern, because what fraudsters have figured out is they'll get cards in their real name or their family's name. They'll go on a shopping spree, and then 2 days later report, oh, my card was stolen, right? Or a family will do that. And
Then they have the security camera, and there you are.
That's one way they could catch them. But usually what the credit card companies look for is patterns. There's so much fraud, George, that's going on in today's world that the credit card companies really have to pick and choose what cases they're really going to investigate because, I mean, it's billions of dollars of loss. There's not enough people that are working as fraud investigators at the card issuers or the credit card processors to handle the amount of fraud cases that are happening today. So that's why they're going after cases like the Albert Gonzalez case, and I don't recall the Russian, there was four Russians, I believe, and Russian a Ukrainian case that are in the news today.
And let me,
after the big fish.
Let me ask you this too, Kevin. You know, a lot of telemarketing firms that you buy things through, they're shipping that call overseas. I mean, there are many times I bought something for my kids or my grandparents. You know, the guy comes on and goes, yes, can I talk to you? and you're going, whoa, where am I? I mean, are those people honest?
You never know. I mean, you could be, you know, here, you know, I'm in Las Vegas right now. You could be at a casino and somebody could use a device to skim your credit card information or your call could be routed to India or the Philippines. And you have a dishonest person on the other end.
Catherine Albrecht was on my television show, Beyond Belief, and she demonstrated with a scanner, she could just walk right by you. So you have your wallet in your back pocket.
Yes.
She could walk right by you and grab your numbers with this electronic machine if she could get to within like a couple feet from you.
Yeah, but on those cards where they use RFID, to actually pay for a particular transaction.
Probably.
For every transaction, what they call the CVV number, which is on the back of your card, on those types of transaction, it changes for every transaction, which is usually a low amount, like $20-$25. So what you should actually really have to do to defraud somebody is take multiple reads of their card and go use it in the same order, in the order that you're able to read it, before the real victim actually uses their card, because then it puts all the codes out of sequence. The way the banks mitigate that fraud or that risk is it's a very low value. You can only spend $20-$25 doing those types of transactions. And that's how they limit the fraud. Just like going to the ATM, usually your bank only allows you to withdraw up to $500 per day. And that's how they mitigate the fraud.
It's not going to go away, Kevin. I guarantee you, you'll be on this program again talking about a case that may be even bigger than the one we're talking about right now.
Yeah, it's never going to end. We're always going to hear about these types of cases. But, you know, as the industry comes out with better technologies and better services to kind of make it harder for the fraudsters to do their tradecraft, you know, the innovative fraudsters are going to figure out new ways. You have to think about it. Like here in Las Vegas, everybody always wants to beat the video poker machine. So we hear about it like every so often, every few years, somebody is pretty ingenious and figures out a way to defeat the technology to beat Vegas. But usually they're caught in the end.
Well, and that's the bottom line. Do these people actually think they're not going to get caught, even though this one takes 10 years?
Yeah, that's unfortunate. They probably feel invincible and that they're smarter than, you know, the government agencies that are going to investigate them. But usually the FBI gets their man in the end.
They sure do. Kevin Mitnick, thanks so much for being on the program. He's an expert at hacking. When we come right back, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe with a series of stories that'll just blow your mind. Next on Coast to Coast AM.